Mr. Randy MacDonald, Janet Matten, Glenn Whitewick, Jay Hannon, and Robert Orth from IBM, colleagues from the University of Melbourne, ladies and gentlemen, a very warm welcome to tonight's IBM Centennial Lecture. My name is John Dewar, I'm the Provost and today Acting Vice-Chancellor of the University of Melbourne. And I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're gathered this evening, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. Now, I've been asked to remind you before we proceed with tonight's lecture to please turn off all mobiles and pagers, and to be aware that the lecture and the questions and answers that will follow will be recorded. Can I say that we're delighted to welcome Randy MacDonald to the university today? His visit marks a significant moment in an extremely important partnership between the University of Melbourne and IBM. It's a partnership that brings together the research and development capacity of one of the world's major IT companies with the research and teaching resources of Australia's leading and one of the world's leading universities. The partnership was highlighted early last year with the announcement of a joint IBM University of Melbourne co-laboratory for the life sciences by the then Premier John Brumby. It developed further with a later announcement here in this building, and I think in this very room, by Prime Minister Julia Gillard and senior IBM executives of an IBM Research and Development Centre here at the University of Melbourne last October. This partnership between the university and IBM is helping advance important research on smarter natural resource management and natural disaster management. And further exciting research work lies ahead for the partnership in healthcare and life science analytics. So to our guest speaker tonight, Mr. Randy MacDonald holds bachelor's and master's degrees from St. Francis University in Pennsylvania. He's held a number of important corporate positions in the human resources field, including executive vice president of human resources and administration for GTE, which is probably better known today as Verizon Communications. Randy joined IBM in 2000 as senior vice president, human resources, in which role he reports to IBM's chairman and CEO, Sam Palmisano. Randy's responsible for the human resources practices, policies, and operations of IBM worldwide, which employs over 400,000 people. His career distinctions include twice receiving the Distinguished Human Resources Executive Award from the Academy of Management. He's a member and past chair of Cornell University's Center for Advanced Human Resources Study and is a fellow and vice chair of the National Academy of Human Resources. And he served on President Clinton's Advisory Commission on Consumer Protection and Quality in the Healthcare Industry. He's a trustee of his alma mater, St. Francis University, and is also a trustee of Bucknell University. Tonight, as IBM celebrates its centenary, its 100th year, Randy will speak to us on reinventing the modern corporation, after which he will respond to questions from the audience. It's a real pleasure to have Randy at the University of Melbourne, so will you please join me now in welcoming Mr. Randy MacDonald.
I have this on? Very good. I started as an electrical engineer. I quickly stopped, so I wanted to make sure I knew how to turn this on. Thank you, John. It is a pleasure to be here at the University of Melbourne. I am truly honored to speak to all of you today. As John noted, this marks IBM's 100th anniversary. Typical of IBMers, we don't view this only as an occasion to celebrate our past. Instead, we are looking ahead, and we're thinking about what our 100-year history tells us about the world of today, and more importantly, the world of tomorrow, if you will, over the next 100 years. We have learned that institutions are not permanent structures. even when they are very successful. Rather, we suggest that they are evolving organisms, and the job of each generation is to adapt them to the world that is truly in motion. So let me begin tonight with two questions. First, what enables a company to survive 100 years? And second, how can it remain a leader for such a long time? In 1962, Thomas Watson Jr., IBM's chairman and son of its founder, stood before the lectern at another great university, Columbia University in New York City, and addressed an audience of future leaders. IBM had recently turned 50. Tom was invited to offer his thoughts on what a half a century of corporate life had taught his company, and what other leaders might learn from that history. He began with what we believe is a striking statistic of the top 2,500 corporations in the U.S. in the 1900, only two remained on that list by 1961. One of those, because it had absorbed six others from the original list, two companies disappeared and the remaining 15 slipped far behind. He said, quote, "Figures like these help to remind us that corporations are expendable and that success at best is an impermanent achievement which can always slip out of one's hand," end quote. So what has 100 years of history taught us? Well, one thing they have taught us is that Tom was right. Success is truly fleeting. Of the top 25 companies on the Fortune 500 list at the time of Watson's lecture, only four remained in 2010. More importantly, though, the past 50 years have taught us that something about how any business or institution can achieve continued success and have impact, it's really quite simple. Long-term success is the product of managing for the long term. I believe that three lessons in particular are of special urgency for the world that you inherit, that we will inherit as tomorrow's leaders, today's leaders, and to decisions that we all will need to make for our organizations and our communities as we go forward. First, how the organization must change as the world economy changes. Second, how the organization must change in response to changing technologies. And third, how the organization must remain the same at its core in the face of that changing world. Lesson one, the single most important reality facing businesses and institutions today is the reality of globalization. Of course, the world has been going global for a long time. We all know that that's nothing new. But what this means in each successive era is very different. Being a global corporation today is very different from what it was when IBM was founded just 100 years ago. From the time that he arrived at CTR, IBM's predecessor company, Thomas Watson Sr. believed that globalization was ultimately inevitable. Throughout most of the 20th century, that meant becoming what economic historians would later come to call the multinational. In this model, the parent corporation created many versions, if you will, of itself in a country after country to effectively operate amid the crazy quilt of international trade and regulatory barriers. IBM itself was one of the clearest examples of a mid-century multinational. All that began to change, however, in the 80s and the 90s with the lowering of the trade barriers, and especially the emergence of the World Wide Web. As a result, a massive global rebalancing occurred and frankly continues today. In part, this is about the world becoming smaller and flatter, Global integration is creating new economic opportunity. Most importantly, hundreds of millions of people around the world are truly entering the middle class. They are becoming consumers. They are becoming entrepreneurs. And this is a macroeconomic fact of historic proportion. Because we believe that this shift was we've always believed that this shift was inevitable. We have transformed IBM over the past decade from the old multinational model to something new, to what we call the globally integrated enterprise. This is not only changing the market opportunities we pursue, but also the way we work and the way we run the company, from sales to marketing to HR to research. We have moved expertise and we have moved decision-making out of corporate headquarters. Today, IBM's operations are globally networked. Our procurement function, for instance, is headquartered in China. Our web services delivery model is located in Brazil. And our staff functions are in places that once seemed far aflung. We have also changed our understanding of the skills, relationship, and responsibilities that IBMers must assume to make this globally integrated model work. Today, those old multinational approaches no longer work. We now must create a whole generation, if you will, of global professionals, and even beyond that, global citizens. And the model of overseas assignments won't scale to that any longer. So 3 years ago, we launched an experiment. We called it the Corporate Service Corps. It puts together diverse teams of high-potential IBMers from around the world. It sends them for a month to communities and cities emerging markets, such as Ghana, the Philippines, Turkey, Vietnam. They work in communities with NGOs and local leaders to jumpstart, if you will, those economies, and to make, if you will, those cities smarter. And when they come back, they spread what they've learned to their colleagues through the concept of what we're all living with today, social media. The results have been highly encouraging. Not only can we provide this experiment to far more IBMers, thousands rather than perhaps hundreds, but these targeted interventions are having a transformative impact, both on the local communities and on IBMers themselves. Most IBMers come back and say it is one of the most meaningful experiences of their life. By the way, it is also helping us to gather valuable learning about the reality of on the ground in these emerging markets. It's strengthening, if you will, IBM's societal relationships, and it is surfacing profitable new business opportunities. The rapid changes and intense pressures inherent in the era of a global and modern business will demand an ever-increasing degree of agility, flexibility, and something that is very relevant here, innovation. All of us must come together to produce economic and societal value as well as marketplace impact. Frankly, this means seeing the planet as a whole, not just through the lens, if you will, of a particular geography. My slide is a little bit off, but lesson two, the role of technology, if you will, for today's leaders. It is widely accepted that the major shifts in technology have had a profound impact on the course of history and on the form of human organizations. Over the course of the last century, the most profound impact has come in our minds and in several other minds from information technology. We have seen it evolve from a set of tools to an industry, to a science, to a pervasive aspect of the modern world. Through this era, IT has become much more than a back office engine or a never-ending flow of consumer gadgets. It has become something that every leader must master. And I really don't mean about how to learn how to tweet or to use an iPad. Technology is the way we now see the world, including those dimensions that are frankly invisible to the human eye. It's how we map, it's how we understand the dynamics of the world's complex systems. And it's increasingly how we decide, the best course of action, and more importantly, to put it in effect. Frankly, this technology now pervades every aspect of the way our world works, the systems, the processes that enable services to be delivered, physical goods to be developed, manufactured, and sold. Everything from people to freight to oil, water, electrons to move. Billions of people work and live in that environment. Today, there are nearly a billion transistors per human. And each one costs about 0.001 of a cent. There are 4 billion mobile phone subscribers, 30 billion radio frequency identification tags that are produced globally. These sensors and the devices that give us, for the first time, if you will, immediate instrumentation, represent a wide range of the world's systems, both natural and man-made. But the planet isn't just instrumented. It's also interconnected. Today, there are 2 billion people on the internet. But systems and objects can now speak to one another too. It's what some call, if you will, the Internet of Things. Think about the prospect of a trillion connected, instrumented objects, cars, cameras, roadways, pipelines, even livestock and pharmaceuticals. All of this is creating vast amounts of data. And through advanced analytics and even more powerful supercomputers, we now believe that we can take that data and turn it into, if you will, insight. You will miss this if you see technology merely as a succession of gadgets, websites, and the next big things. IBM's history tells us that there is more here than meets the eye. Gadgets, if you will, come and go, and they ultimately become commoditized. But there's a deeper role, if you will, for information technology as a science, as a pervasive fact of the way our world works. That's something that I believe is all of us as human beings have an obligation to understand. It's not necessarily the mechanics, it's the implications. IBM has been a leader in every dimension of the IT's evolution. We actually began making clocks and scales, and believe it or not, we even made cheese slicers. In addition to the punch card tabulator, we made other technologies that has evolved. But we never identified our purpose with one product or one technology. We invented and applied a remarkable succession of them, if you will, typewriters, vacuum tube calculators, magnetic tape, the first disk drive, the memory chip, Fortran, fractals, ATMs, mainframes, mini computers, personal computers, supercomputers. Today we still provide many of those, along with advanced services and advanced technologies. But some of them we don't. It's all about, if you will, reinvention. For example, we introduced the IBM PC in 1981 and the very popular ThinkPad in 1992. Excuse me, we introduced the PC in 1981, the ThinkPad in 1992. It was by any measure the most recognizable brand for us, and arguably the only brand that touched individuals. Tens of millions of people had our ThinkPad. But for all these reasons, the idea that we would divest the PC business was for many, pardon the pun, unthinkable. We are innovators. In 1981, the PC was an innovation. 20 years later, it had lost much of its differentiation. It was time to move on. It was time to focus on the future. We are entering a very different world, and we can only begin to see the challenges that we'll face in years to come. Each of you, as human beings on this planet, must understand and grapple with the new issues that this information era will present and work to push our organizations and the systems of the future. Lesson 3, how the organization retains its distinctive core through continual change, is, as our mind is the foundation piece. Perhaps Thomas Watson Sr.'s most enduring contribution to the world was the notion that an organization can and must undertake the intentional creation of its own culture. Of course, every organization, city, or community has a culture. It's usually an extension of the organization's founder, their beliefs, if you will, their actions, their decisions, their personality. Now, there's no question that the cult of personality in business is a powerful lure. The idea of a charismatic superstar leader. The press, it cultivates it. The street trades on it. Some employees crave it. Thomas Watson himself was an example, if you will, of it. But how you bottle up what makes an organization distinctive? For instance, what makes Australia, Australia? Or for that matter, what makes the University of Melbourne, the University of Melbourne? And make that lasting foundation for you, for your own organization's culture. 50 years ago, in his lectures at Columbia University, Watson Jr. located the vitality of an organization culture not in the rituals of like team building exercises or company songs, even though, frankly, we did all of that as well. But he focused it in on the shared values or belief that we had. He said, and I quote again, "I firmly believe that any organization, in order to survive and achieve success, must have a sound set of beliefs on which it premises all its policies and all its actions. Next, I believe that the most important single factor in corporate success is the faithful adherence to those beliefs. And finally, I believe that if an organization is to meet the challenges of the changing world, it must be prepared to change everything about itself except those beliefs as it moves through its corporate transformation," end quote. Thomas Watson was not necessarily talking about moral precepts. This is not about legal compliance or, if you will, ethical behavior. Obviously, every organization needs to do that. For him, and for IBM, a company's beliefs were about its identity. What makes it distinct? What shapes its decisions? What influences its behavior? If you could codify and sustain that core, it would ensure that the company continues to remain unique, remains differentiated, decade after decade. I would argue that the need for this foundation is greater today than ever before. In a globalizing world with work spread across vast networks of organizations and performed by vast individuals around the world, people need something to hold them together that provides a touchstone for their actions and for their decisions. You know, one of the first things that Sam Palmisano did as CEO was to initiate an effort to re-examine our core values. But he didn't do it the traditional way. You know, we no longer live in a world where the chairman can simply lay out the company's, if you will, basic beliefs. IBMers, frankly, are super smart bunch of people, and smart people today tend to be rather independent, and frankly, even a bit cynical. You can't come down, if you will, from the mountain and tell everybody, these are your values. So we took a different approach. We came together online as a global population of over 72 hours in what we called a jam. And we hashed it out. Frankly, it was messy, but it was passionate. It was contentious. But the values that emerged were not IBM's values. They were the values of IBMers. A huge difference. We've done a lot of work since. We have globally integrated our company. We have remade IBM's portfolio of products and services, including the divestiture of our PC business, which I had previously mentioned. That decision, which really, frankly, could have caused a rift inside the company, was instead ultimately embraced. It was embraced not merely on the basis of economics or business strategy, but it was because it was consistent with the way we did it within the value set that we created. IBM's history, in fact, can be seen as a century-long experiment in how to institutionalize and perpetuate what makes us. And as the next generation of leaders within IBM and for us in this room, I would suggest that it will be our fundamental job, no matter what kind of work that we do or what we do with that organization or that community, that we lead and we drive that transformational change. That measure of any entity, business, government, university, or other institution, ultimately is answered in two questions. What was its impact, and how is the world different because it existed? As I said, long-term success is the product of managing for the long term. And I believe that managing for the long term most fundamentally comes down to an enduring and evolving identity or culture. Again, grounded in core values that do not change regardless of the business strategy. I have a personal example, an example that frankly I like to share to make the point. Early last year, my human resources team took a long-term view of our organization and looked at the future possibilities and implications of the human resource function, its profession, where it is, and where we are going. We initiated a project called HR Think Future, which was designed to envision the future of work and how the human resources organization must adapt to support the evolving global workforce in the next 5 to 20 years. In essence, we were asking ourselves the question, what do we have to put in as a foundation to ensure that we make it for the next 100 years. 5 teams of IBM executives, HR executives, managers, and newly hired professionals were commissioned to predict, if you will, and analyze the workforce of the future. You know, the following points reflect some of the conclusions and thinking brought forward by these teams as they looked at the future of work. The first point was that technology will enable a very different set of employment models in the future. These models would include relationships with innovation centers, such as universities, which we've talked about today, and think tanks, and joint employment relationships with clients who both share and pay for the same talent based on business requirements. Talent as a cloud, if you will. The teams also believe that future leaders will work in an environment where global differences are much more pronounced and where opposing views become the norm within the workplace. In this more fluid, more diverse, more interconnected world of work, leaders must have the insight and skills to recognize the differences and allow those differences to serve as catalysts to conduct the world of business. If you will, those differences, no matter how they take shape or form, will provide yet a further wave of innovation for the next 100 years. In a future that will become increasingly instrumented and interconnected, the team saw a workforce that will frankly operate differently in ways that have broad implications for both HR as a function and for the business, and by the way, for individual practitioners. For example, employees will have a powerful and increasingly portable cloud technology levers, if you will, at their own fingertips that will let them directly influence their own reputation and that of the organization. This technology will allow them to make connections both inside and outside their employment circles and foster visibility, if you will, on a global scale. The future workforce as a whole, these teams believed, on one hand, will crave that independence that a new employment model will deliver in this new era of work. On the other hand, future employees would also crave a sense of belonging or having a sense of connection, frankly, to one or more employers. Well-managed companies in the future will know how to supply that employment connection and lever off that for future retention. Finally, leaders of the future must be able to work together to ensure success. We talk about collaboration today, but so collaboration will become even more important as a reality of the workplace. And social networking will become important to leaders as well, as Facebook is, frankly, to teenagers today. We frankly believe that today's world finds itself at an inflection point. In that evolution, in that application of technology, if you will, in the continuing march of global integration, and the ways in which we manage and sustain our institutions, that inflection point to be recognized and dealt with today is absolutely critical. For all of us in this room, and more importantly, for the next generation of leaders, this, if you will, is the dawn of a new age, one that we really have an ultimate opportunity to affect. Frankly, we believe in IBM, we have a historical obligation to shape that future. The good news is that the key precondition for reality change now exists, and that condition is simple. Look at the world today. People demand it. They are hungry for leadership. Such a moment in our minds doesn't come around very often, perhaps a few times every century. And frankly, it will not last. And so therefore, we in IBM urge you to endorse it, to embrace it, and to make it happen. Despite the litany of challenges we face, and there are several, I believe that forward-thinking individuals, communities, and companies will take those forces and to begin to think about what they can do to create a knowledge-based transfer, to create a smarter, a more secure, a more sustainable planet. We have been here on this earth for 100 years. We stand before you excited about the opportunity. I was in New Zealand yesterday, here today, and in Sydney tomorrow. And as I talk to IBMers, I say that we have a unique opportunity. And I would suggest to you that all of us have an opportunity. As IBMers, several people 100 years ago, sat around a table and created a vision, created an opportunity for a remarkable corporation, founded on beliefs and founded and managed on a value system that continues today. Our IBMers, our team, my colleagues, have a unique opportunity right now to establish yet the new foundation for the next 100 years. And those next 100 years represent an opportunity for all of us, because it fundamentally means that we bring the world together. We communicate and we act differently. We create a level of transformation that allows each and every country to have the ability to create the middle class, the ability to create an educational system, a communicational system that ultimately may bring world peace. It is an opportunity. IBMers are ready to seize it. Our question to the rest of the world is, will you seize it with us? Thank you. Take some questions.
Thank you very much for that fascinating address. I'm delighted that we now have about 20 minutes for questions and answers. So, ladies and gentlemen, please direct your questions to me and I will invite Randy to answer them. So, any questions?
The question for those who perhaps may did not hear it is, what are the challenges of globalization and our experiences with that? Well, I was talking to someone just before I walked in the room. When you globally integrate the enterprise, the first challenge that you have unequivocally is the loss of identity within the country, with the individual and with the unit. And so consequently, it is a difficult process to get people to relinquish, if you will, what they owned. And the ability to kind of decide what you're going to use in that globally integrated process as the benchmark, as the best practice, can often be the conflicted point. And the story I can give you as an example is that quite often, especially being a US-based centric thinking company that we used to be, everybody would have thought we would have gravitated to the US way of doing everything. Of course, you know, in the US, we know everything, so it's very simple. But we didn't do that. We made a conscious effort to look at best practices from around the world. I inherited, for instance, in that globally integrated enterprise, 37 payroll systems. It would have been natural to take one of the bigger ones. We picked an SAP program that was written in Belgium and said that was the best practice. A small country led the rest of the world. Early on, some of the biggest challenges to send signals about the reality is that we're not engulfing the world for the purpose of control. We're engulfing the world, if you will, for total transformation. The follow-up point. So what do you do once you have success? You begin to release again. Once you create the practice, once you create the operational excellence, you then give back to the people in the countries some level of local flexibility that allows their culture to interact with what that process is. It's a marrying of the two, but it's an extended period of time to do it. Other questions?
I think it was the CEO of IBM who said in the 60s that he saw a world market for five computers. I think the quote is that he saw a world market for five computers.
Five computers?
Yeah. And I'm just wondering what it was about the IBM culture that allowed that view to be overcome. Obviously, computers became a significant part of IBM's business. So, and does it still exist now?
I think it's a very simple answer, is that IBMers are allowed to have provocative, creative ideas and are willing and capable and allowed to express those. And I talked about the differences of opinions that will occur as this generation evolves. I think we've already started that in our DNA. it's acceptable to have a different idea because that leads to innovation.
I can understand how you can possibly use IT to manage an organization of 450,000 people, but how do you exercise effective leadership in an organization of 450,000 people, particularly when change is needed?
Leadership in the end is very personal. You cannot, you know, even though perhaps some of the client reps would like me to argue that technology is a means to that end of leadership, in the end, I think there's a personalization of leadership, and you go back to your value system. You go back to dedicated to client success. Notice in our value system, we don't talk about dedicated to our success. We talk about our client success. Leaders are taught to say that if the client's successful, it's natural that we will become successful. We talk about innovation in the context of not just for IBM, but for society. So it sets the mode. Where I ultimately go is in the third value on leadership. It's a very interesting use of the words. Trust and personal responsibility. What we are fundamentally saying as an IBM leader, you have an ethical and moral obligation to establish a level of trust with the people that you work with. Trust them to do what is right, what is prudent, and what is correct. The employee that you trust has an equal obligation to accept personal responsibility in using that trust. And again, I think it's within the DNA of that technological environment that you have some things that just become personal. The interesting thing, and in spirit of bluntness, when you look at trust and personal responsibility within a manager, within a work unit, the level of satisfaction runs between 86% favorable and 92% favorable. All of us get very excited about that. That's the bad news. That's the bad news. The worst news is that what it's fundamentally saying is, my unit's okay, my management is okay. It's wrong there, it's wrong here, it's wrong there, it's wrong there. So our bigger problem now is to begin to think how you create that collaboration on a virtual basis to create that trust beyond and through the organization. This is singularly one of the biggest problems we're having right now to create that community of interest.
Has IBM talked about or considered a range of future scenarios and then maybe considered one or two of those and the kinds of decisions that it's making today in terms of helping to shape its future around one of those preferred futures?
The answer is yes, and I won't tell you which ones they are. I joke a little. I understand, I'm just joking. I think that it wasn't a hint, it was rather direct in response to this gentleman here. I think one of the fundamental things that we have to think about as a corporation, and it's reflective of the last 100 years moving to the next 100 years, is the way we lead and the way we manage will fundamentally have to change as the workforce becomes more instrumented, more interconnected, cultural differences begin to come into play. We are now into what I might call the last frontier, Africa. The issues that I face in HR in Africa, I've been in the HR business 41 years, I've never faced them anywhere else. They're unique, they're different, they're cultural, there are health issues, there are compensation issues, there are safety issues, there are security issues, there are leadership issues. It's the broad array. And you begin to look at the quality of the talent that we're going to have to affect the education system with. Takes the models that we have been used to and fundamentally has to change. Everything is out the window. And it's going to be driven heavily by technology.
Randy, thank you very much. I think that's all the questions we have time for this evening. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we've been privileged to enjoy a conversation with IBM's most senior leaders on a topic of enormous interest to the corporate world and universities alike. Randy, I'd like to thank you most sincerely for being with us tonight and for sharing those perspectives from, I think, your unique vantage point in one of the world's truly leading corporations in such a warm, friendly and approachable way, if I might say. And on behalf of the University of Melbourne community, allow me to pass on this very small token of our appreciation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But don't go away, or at least if you do, please come back again on Thursday, the 30th of June, for the next IBM Centennial Lecture, to be delivered by Dr. Sharon Nunes, Vice President for Big Green Innovations in IBM Systems and Technology Group. Sharon's lecture will be on the theme of the role of IT in sustaining the world's water resources. We hope to see you all then, but in the meantime, Randy, thank you once again. Thank you very much.